Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. We are rolling through the book of Numbers, and today's podcast is focusing on chapter 11, and it is entitled Quails. Yeah, you have to have your voice crack when you say quails, otherwise it doesn't work. For us to talk about Numbers chapter 11, we have to understand the background and the stories and the events that led to Numbers chapter 11. So two books before the book of Numbers is the second book of the Bible, the book of Exodus. And when we read Exodus, we find that the children of Israel have been enslaved by the Egyptian people for 400 years. After 400 years of slavery, the Israelites cry out to God. God hears their prayers and liberates the Israelites with a mighty and miraculous hand. The second half of Exodus then focuses on these Israelites wandering around in the desert on their way back to the promised land, the land of their ancestors in Canaan. Now, it's here that most Christians and most Jews picture that this Exodus is a much smaller scale than it actually is. Most Christians I speak to, when they hear this story of the Exodus, they think to themselves that this is about, you know, somewhere around 5,000 to 10,000 people. But when we read the book of Exodus, Exodus tells us a very different scale of how big the Exodus was. In chapter 12, verse 37, the narrator writes, "The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides children." Now, if we were to assume that there were as many women as there were men, then we can get to a total of 1.2 million people in the Exodus. And if we add a little bit for children, then we realize that the Exodus is taking place on a scale where the author tells us that there are 1.3 million people wandering around the desert. To give you some perspective, that number is the same population as the city of Dallas, Texas today. So when you think of the Exodus and the Israelites in the desert and the wilderness, it's important to understand that the Bible is professing that 1.3 million people compose this group of wanderers. So it's here that we get to Numbers chapter 11, when 1.3 million people are in the desert, and the story begins with the Israelites approaching Moses, and these are the words they say to Moses: "If only we had meat to eat." They then go on to reminisce about what they used to eat before the Exodus happened. In verse 5, we read, "We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at." Now, at this point, you may say to yourself, "Well, I'm not really familiar with the food manna." So the narrator begins to describe what manna is. In verse 7, the narrator writes, "Now manna was like coriander seed, and its color was like the color of gum resin. The people went around and gathered it, ground it in mills or beat it in mortars, then boiled it in pots and made cakes of it. And the taste of manna was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. When the dew fell on the camp in the night, the manna would fall with it." So the narrator is telling us how you feed 1.3 million people wandering around in the desert. Every day, God would create this miracle where the Israelites would wake up and there lying on the ground next to the dew was this food called manna. And manna had tasted like cakes baked with oil. So you can imagine bread with oil. And it resembled coriander seeds with a little bit more translucency like gum resin. So it's here that the Israelites are complaining to Moses after eating manna, which was this miraculous food supply. And they are saying to Moses, "Look, Moses, if only we had meat to eat, then we could be happy." Now, when we read these words in 2019, they come across as something like this. The Israelites are saying to Moses, "We are tired of this endless, miraculous supply of free food." So our modern mindset responds to their complaining with a question and exclamation, which is, "Can you believe these guys? Every day they wake up to a miracle and they look at it and they say, yeah, we'd like some meat." Most modern readers are annoyed at this request because it shows their calloused indifference toward the miracle working of God. Now it's here that I'd like to ask you a question. What is your favorite food? And I want you to actually think about what your favorite food is. And when you have that, I have another question for you. How many days in a row could you eat that food for every meal? Not just once a day, not just twice a day, but for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. If someone said, here is an endless supply of free food, of your favorite food, how many days in a row could you eat it before you said, I know I said this is my favorite food, but I'd really like to mix it up a little. Now, it would be fun if we could conduct an experiment and see how long you or I could eat this food without requesting something different. But the good news is I've already conducted this experiment. Because one of my best friends is a man named Dr. Eric Peterson, who is a rocket scientist here in the area near Paradox. Now, Eric Peterson and I have grown up together, and there is one story that took place not too long ago. Oh, let's face it, it was a while ago. He was 9 and I was 8, and I went over to his house one day and I asked him what we were having for dinner. He looks at me with a smile and he says, Craig, I'm going to see how long I can eat my favorite food in a row before I say to myself, you know, I'd like something different. And so I said to Eric, I said, okay, what's your favorite food? And he said, Morningstar veggie corn dogs. Can I get an amen? Yeah. So Eric says, we're having veggie corn dogs for dinner tonight. And I say, how long have you been eating only veggie corn dogs? And he says, this is my third day. I've had it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 3 meals in a row for 3 days in a row if I have it for dinner tonight. So that night, we feasted on veggie corn dogs. I remember calling Eric the next day after breakfast and saying, hey, I just want to see if your streak is still intact and you're still eating veggie corn dogs. And Eric said to me, he's like, actually, I got kind of sick of them last night, so I switched and had cereal this morning. So apparently the longest most human beings in modern society can go with eating their food is about 3 days before they say, you know, I want something else. So that shifts our attention back to the Israelites who are complaining about an endless supply of miraculous free food. And the question begins to form in our mind, well, how long have they been eating this for? And if we look at the text closely, we come across Numbers chapter 10 that tells us in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the covenant. This is the story right before Numbers chapter 11, where the Israelites say, we'd like some meat. And when you look at those words carefully, and you add up those days individually, then what comes across is the fact that the Israelites have been eating only manna for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 810 days in a row. 2 years of manna in the morning, manna at lunchtime, and manna for dinner. And this sea of people cries out to Moses and says, you know, we've had enough of this coriander seed, cakey, oily bread. We want something different. Now we read in Numbers 11, verse 10, about God and Moses' reaction. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, all at the entrance of their tents. Then the Lord became very angry, and Moses was displeased. Now Moses is so displeased that he goes before God and has a class 5 hurricane meltdown. Moses says to God, why have you treated your servant so badly? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all the people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give birth to them? For which I picture God answering, no. Moses goes on, that you, God, should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a suckling child to the land that you promised an oath to their ancestors. Where am I to get meat to give all these people, God? For they come weeping to me and say, give us meat to eat. I am not able to carry all this people alone, for they are too heavy for me. If this is the way you, God, are going to treat me, put me to death at once. If I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my misery. Moses hears the Israelites crying out and saying, we're sick of this food after over 2 years. And Moses' reaction is to go before God and say, if that's the way you're going to treat me, God, then just kill me. Now, God hears Moses' meltdown and responds in the next several verses. God first institutes a new form of government in which Moses can delegate the problems to 70 elders, and they can help them litigate over the people. God then addresses Moses and says, you need to go talk to the Israelite people about this meat problem. God says, say to the Israelites this, and we read about this in verse 18. God's message to Moses to give to the Israelites is this: consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat, for you have wailed in the hearing of the Lord, saying, if only we had meat to eat, surely it was better for us in Egypt. Therefore, God says, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not only one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but for a whole month. And then God goes off the rails by saying, until your meat comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you. Now, if you're like me, you're reading this and you're thinking to yourself, oh God, why did you have to go crazy? God goes on to say, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wailed before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? God is so insulted by the Israelites' request for some different form of food other than manna that God says, fine, I'll give you meat and it will come out of your noses until you're sick of it. All because the people said we'd rather be in Egypt. Now, Moses has a rather interesting reaction to God's proclamation. Moses, in verse 21, says, the people I am with number 600,000 on foot, and you say I will give them meat that they will eat for a whole month? Are there enough flocks and herds to slaughter for them, God? Are there enough fish in the sea to catch for them? So Moses hears God's claim that God's going to create so much meat or bring so much meat before the Israelites that it will come out of their noses. And Moses responds by saying, yeah, right. There's not enough meat in this desert to satisfy all of these 1.3 million people. God becomes angry with Moses' challenge. So angry, in fact, that God refers to God's self in the third person. God says to Moses, is the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. Then we'll jump down to verse 31 where we read these words. Then a wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quails from the sea and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, about 2 cubits deep on the ground. Now, the religious tendency to interpret this story is to say that God heard the cry and request of the Israelites and God provided. This is reflected in the 105th Psalm, when the psalmist writes these words, they, the children of Israel, asked and God brought quails and gave them food from heaven in abundance. But is that really what's happening here? Because when you look closely at the text, the number of quail seems rather large. And thanks to geometry, we can actually figure out how many quail God sends. Now, if you've ever listened to this podcast and said to yourself, man, I wish this podcast had more math than my brothers and sisters, this episode is for you. And if you're thinking to yourself, man, didn't we talk about math like 2 episodes ago? I would say, yes, of course we did, because we're in the book of Numbers. So I think it's appropriate that we do some math when we study the book of Numbers, right? So let's use some math to figure out just how much quail God sends in Numbers 11. So let's begin with the assumption that there are 1.3 million people wandering around the desert. Now, 1.3 million people is a lot of people, and 1.3 million people take up a lot of space. So as we said earlier, this is the same population as the city of Dallas. Now, if we look at the city of Dallas, Dallas is approximately 340 square miles of land. So let's assume the same population density of Dallas for the Israelites camping in a circle. Now, if you know anything about geometry, you know how to calculate the area of a circle, which is pi r squared. And if the area is 340 miles, all we have to do is divide by pi and then take the square root. And we find out that the radius is 10 and a half miles. From there, we return to Numbers 11 and we read about how God let the quails fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on that side. So let's assume that a day's journey is about 21 miles. With that in mind, we return to our Dallas circle with a radius of 10.5 miles and we add 21 miles as a circle around all of the camp. That means our radius of our new circle is 31.5 miles. And because we know the formula, A equals pi r squared, we know that this circle is 3,117 square miles. Now, because the text specifies that the quail fell around the camp and not in the camp, we have to subtract 340 square miles where the quail did not fall, which means that we have an area of 2,777 square miles of quail. Are you having a good time as you're listening to this podcast? Now, it's here that we return to the text and we read that this was not just a flat bed of quail, but these quail were about 2 cubits deep on the ground. A cubit is about 18 inches, so that means the quail were 3 feet deep, 21 miles in a circle around the camp. Now, because of this, we have to convert square miles into square feet. And the question is, how many square feet are in a mile? Well, the answer is no one knows because we're not on the metric system, and I'm still bitter about this. So we go to Google and we find out that there are 27,878,000 square feet per mile. We take that number and we times it by 2,777 square miles of quail, and we find that we have 77 billion square feet of quail. Now, to get the volume of how much quail is on top of that square footage of quail, we multiply that by 3 feet deep and we come up to 232 billion cubic feet of quail. We then have to estimate the volume of a quail, and I'm gonna assume that you can put about 4 quails per cubic foot. Assuming that a quail is about 0.25 cubic feet, that means that God sent 929 billion with a B, 929 billion quails in Numbers 11. If you divide that number by 1.3 million, you find that God sent enough for 714,000 quails per person. This is not a few quails for the Israelites to mix up their diet. This is a plague. Now, if we're wondering if the author of Numbers meant to say that God sent that many quails, the author doubles down in the next verse. We read, "So the people worked all that day and night and all the next day gathering the quails. The least anyone gathered was 10 homers." Now, a homer is equivalent to 220 quarts or 220 liters. And the least that anyone gathered was 10 homers. That is a lot of quail. We then read that the Israelites spread the quail out for themselves all around the camp. And when we read this story with doing the calculation and figuring out how much this author perceived to be the number of quail, the story becomes God hearing the Israelites' request for meat and saying, "You want meat? Well, I'll give you meat." And just when this story can't get any weirder or darker, we find that it actually does get weirder and darker. Because in verse 33, the narrator writes, "But while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people. And the Lord struck the people with a very great plague." So that place was called Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had the craving. Kibroth Hattaavah translates into English, "the graves of the ones who craved." And it's here that the story in Numbers 11 ends. Well, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. So I'm going to sign off here. We'll close with prayer, and you guys have a good day. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that because this story is confusing, disheartening, strange, and horrific. And at the center of this story is this question about what this story says about the character of God. A question that we should ask when reading Numbers 11 is simply this: is God good in this story? And if you're like me, you ask that question and your head starts to play a game where your head starts to say things like this: I feel like the answer should always be yes to the question of if God is good, but I'm pretty sure that when I read Numbers 11, the answer is no. But I'm also pretty sure that when I answer that no, God isn't good in this story, then that's when I become a heretic. Whew. And this story presents a lose-lose situation for the interpreter or the reader of this story. So we're left with this question of if God is actually good in this story. And if God isn't in this story, then is God actually good? Well, to help us answer that question, I'd like to ask another question. Is God's behavior in Numbers 11 justified? Now, it's here that religious people often rush in and try to justify the behavior of God, even though it's dark, even though it's weird, even though it's tyrannical, and say God had to do this because God had no other choice, because God is always justice. So it's here that I'd like for us to look at how people have justified God's behavior in this chapter before. Now, the first and most common explanation I have heard is that the Israelites asked and God provided. This is the view of the psalmist in the 105th Psalm and is the common view of most religious people reading this story today. There's just one problem. God doesn't provide. God makes the quail a punishment. And this explanation or this justification goes out the window the minute you consider how much quail we're talking about. 929 billion quail, or 714,000 quail per person, is not justified when people say, "May I have some meat?" That goes out the window with the volume of quail the story illustrates. Which brings us to the second explanation that people use to justify God's behavior. The second explanation is something like this: you should not complain about the gifts God gives you. That's the moral of this story. While I hear that, and I used to believe this personally, this justification becomes problematic when you consider that the Israelites have been eating manna for 810 days. I cannot go more than 3 days of eating the same food without complaining about it. How could I expect the Israelites to be better than that? There is something about our biology that drives us to seek nutrition from a wide variety of sources in order to live the healthiest and fullest life that we have. And when we consider that, what happens when God gives the same food day in and day out, three meals a day, God is denying the humanity of the Israelites in this story. And what we want so badly to happen in this story is the Israelites go before Moses and they say, "We long for meat or the cucumbers or the melons we used to have back in Egypt." And we want Moses to say, "Look, I know it's really hard right now. We are trying to create a new society with equal human beings, and that takes some work and requires some sacrifice. So we hope," Moses says, "please bear with us. And just hang on a little bit longer, because soon we will settle down and be able to grow gardens and farm and have a wide variety of wonderful, good foods." But Moses and God don't react that way. Instead, they hear the Israelites saying, "We'd like something different to eat." And their response is overwhelming, seething rage. And it's here when people say, "You should not complain about the gifts God gives you," that I say, I'm pretty sure I'd complain too. I can't imagine eating the same food for that long and not complaining. Which brings us to the third justification I've heard for God's behavior in this story. Religious people often defend God's behavior by saying, "Be careful what you wish for. The Israelites asked God for meat and God gave them meat." Yeah, I hear that. But my response would be, you understand that people died, right? No one wished for death except Moses. And so people requested meat, and yeah, they probably complained about not having meat, and God responded by slaughtering some of them, by giving them a plague. And when you look at this story, in order to justify God's behavior, you have to answer this question. Does a human being ever deserve the death penalty for complaining about food? Well, the answer is no. There is no scenario where you can justify killing people because they say, hey, I don't like this food. Now, you can be annoyed by people who complain about food all the time. You can say to yourself, I need some distance between myself and that person who is a cloud of negative energy. But if you were to say that person needs to die because they're complaining about the food, I'm pretty sure I'm going to stand up and say, no, that's not an equal punishment or a valid response in any universe or any time period. And this is the story that happens. God kills people because they complained about food. And these three justifications and their shortcomings reveal that when we go back to that first question, is God a good God? In Numbers 11, the response that we come up with is no. God in Numbers 11 is not a good God. God is acting unethical in Numbers 11. The Israelites cry out with this desire to have some variety in their diet, and God responds by enacting cruel and unusual punishment. And it's that cruel and unusual punishment that makes me think of another story in the Bible. All the way in the New Testament, there's a story about Jesus Christ, who Christians proclaim to be the Son of God. And it's here toward the end of Luke's gospel that we read about how Jesus, the Son of God, is being attacked. Jesus was put on a corrupt trial by a corrupt religion before a corrupt state. All of this corruption found Jesus to be worthy of death, but not just any death, cruel and unusual execution through crucifixion. So Jesus is forced to march up a hill with a cross on his back. He is then nailed to that cross. He cries out in agony. People are jeering about him. Religion has abandoned him. The state has betrayed him. And he sees his mother weeping. And it's here that we read this story and think of the temper of God in Numbers 11. And we think to ourselves, look out, Romans. The quail are about to descend upon you. But Jesus doesn't do that. No, Jesus in Luke's gospel instead looks at the people who have attacked him and prays on their behalf. The words he says are, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And then Jesus dies. Now we look at this story and compare the temperament of Jesus, the Son of God, to that of God in Numbers 11. And if you're like me, you see this and you say to yourself, there is a disconnect here. There's no way this is the same God, because God in Numbers 11 is petty, is angry, is tyrannical, is willing to kill people at a moment's notice in order to protect God's own ego. And then we read about God in Luke 23, and God doesn't do any of that, but instead prays on behalf of the people who are attacking himself. Now, if you've been with us the last couple of weeks, we've highlighted the differences between these pictures and understandings of God. And while most people would try to push us in a corner and say, well, which one is the true picture of God? A much better question to ask is, what changed? Did God calm down? Did God receive anger management training? Was the wrath of God finally satisfied? And the problem with all of these propositions is it requires God to change, and God is infinite, and God is eternal, and God is all-knowing. And so I think a much more logical and better explanation is that God didn't change, but human beings changed. from Numbers to the Gospel of Luke, there is this motion of how people change their perspective and understanding of who God actually was. The word that we've been using to describe this is expanding human consciousness. And when we compare the story of the cross with the story of the quails, what we find is that human consciousness moves from seeing God as the one enacting cruel executions to the one who is suffering from cruel executions. The story of Numbers is about how the religious and political system embodied in Moses is always justified and always good, even when it isn't, by killing people with quail. The story in Luke is that God is found among those who suffer and are steamrolled by those who are in power. With that in mind, we return to our stories in Numbers 11, and we look at the people who have been steamrolled by power, who have been buried in quail. The Israelites, the former slaves who are being led by a man who does not know what slavery is. Moses grew up in royalty, while the people he is leading grew up with the whip on their back. And it's here that we shift our focus from Moses and we turn it to the former slaves. And we have to ask a question that has not been asked enough. The question is, what are these former slaves trying to tell us? Because what they're trying to tell us may make us uncomfortable and uneasy, but we should trust their testimony because the story of the cross tells us that God is found among those who have suffered from cruel executions. And when you look closely at what the Israelites are saying, it is a rather stunning testimony. They are telling Moses, "We long for meat, for when we were in Egypt, we had fish and cucumbers and melons and onions and leeks and garlic. But here, we're stuck with the same food day in and day out." The testimony of the Israelites is that the slavery of the Egyptians is better than the society of Moses. Now, if you're like me, you hear the Israelites testifying that the slavery is better than the society, and you say to yourself, no, that can't be. And if you feel that defensive edge welling up within you, then I have a question for you. Why don't we believe the testimony of former slaves? Why do we rush to defend God in this story when God's behavior is indefensible? And so often when I hear religious leaders, whether they be Bible teachers or pastors or conference officials, when they talk about this story, what they are talking about is how the Israelites got what they deserved. Why? Why don't we just trust the Israelites? And what I believe Numbers 11 teaches us is that most Christians distrust the testimony of former slaves in an attempt to protect the reputation of God. And religion has this sense that we need to say that God is good all the time, and all the time God is good. But here in Numbers 11, that clearly is not the case. And religion will do whatever it can for you and me to deny God's bad behavior in this story. And yet, God's behavior is terrible. And even when it's clearly terrible, it's so hard for us to say because we feel like we are betraying God when we speak badly about God's reputation. And yet I would argue the cross is encouraging us to not protect the reputation of God, but instead to listen to the voices of those who have been steamrolled by political and religious systems. Now, as we all know, this is not a problem reserved for ancient biblical times. I recently read an article by a woman named Margaret Beiser. Ms. Beiser published this article in August of 2017, and the article's title is, "I used to lead tours at a plantation. You won't believe the questions I got about slavery." Some of the most common questions she got as a white woman leading a tour on a plantation was this: were the slaves here paid? Someone else would ask, did the slaves sign up to work here? And then after the tour was over, she often heard from Christian people, well, the Egyptians enslaved the Israelites, so what goes around comes around, which I'm not even sure makes any sense. In this article, Ms. Beiser talked about one story in particular where after the people of color who were taking the tour as well left, a white person came up to her and said, "Listen, I just wanted to say that dragging all this slavery stuff up again is bringing down America." Ms. Beiser, in response to this, began to speak, but the man cut her off. He says, "You didn't know. You're young. But America is the greatest country in the world. And these people out there, they'd do anything to make America less great." Now, Ms. Beiser then talks in the article about some common misconceptions about slavery. She then wraps up her article by saying these words: "All the misconceptions discussed here serve to prop up one overarching and incorrect belief, that slavery wasn't really all that bad." In other words, what she noticed after leading tours on this plantation was that Americans were desperate to believe that slavery wasn't as evil as slaves said it was. Additionally, people would often point to other countries and say, "Look, American slavery was bad, but it wasn't really that bad compared to the morality of the rest of the world." And she says, "No, it actually was. And if you don't believe me, then listen to what former slaves describe slavery as." When you look at what Numbers 11 says about this story, I believe it tells us that most Americans distrust the testimony of former slaves in an attempt to protect the reputation of America. When people say that slavery was awful, people often discount that or distrust that testimony in order to say, "No, America is great." Now, you may ask me how I know this, and I will tell you. I used to do this. And every now and then, I can feel my ego welling up trying to defend America's reputation by discounting people of color's testimony as to what America actually is. To tell you about this, I'd like to tell you a story. This story took place a long time ago, all the way back when I was in second grade at an elementary school that is not too far from Paradox Church. At this elementary school, so long ago, my faculty and my teachers were exclusively white, with the exception of our choir teacher. Now, our choir teacher arrived when I began the second grade, and I remember liking my choir teacher a lot because I have this tendency and this desire to be a teacher's pet. So our choir teacher would teach us songs, and I really appreciated her and the songs that she would teach us until February rolled around. And I remember walking into her class in February, and she said, "Boys and girls, it's Black History Month." Now, I had never heard a teacher talk about Black History Month before, so I was intrigued as to what Black History Month was. So our choir teacher began to teach us songs that were directly related to Black history. I remember she taught us one song that year that had us repeat the refrain, "Cotton needs picking so bad." And I remember hating that song. I remember being frustrated by that song because that song on some level asked me and forced me to empathize with the people who were suffering from slavery. And as an 8-year-old, I had no interest in doing that. Not only that, but our choir teacher would not let us get away from the fact that this slavery was racially motivated. And as an 8-year-old white kid, I remember being very threatened by this. I was relieved when February finally mercifully ended and we didn't have to talk about Black history in choir anymore. But then third grade happened and February rolled around and our choir teacher had us focus on a different area of Black history for third grade. She told us stories about the Jim Crow era and the horrors of segregation and the evils of discrimination. And I remember as a 9-year-old third grader being annoyed. I didn't think it was helpful for her to bring up the negativity of America's past. I wanted her to focus on the patriotism and the greatness of America. And yet she kept bringing up the problems and the times that America had failed African Americans over and over again. Same thing happened the next year in fourth grade and fifth grade and then sixth grade. And then I moved to junior high and then high school and beyond. And I didn't think much of my choir teacher and the way that she taught Black history during my elementary years. Until 2 years ago, when I was sitting down for lunch with my mentor, Maury Jackson. Now, this was in January of 2017. I remember speaking to him and asking him how things were going, and he responded by saying that things were really busy for him this time of year. I asked him why, and he said, well, let me tell you why. Basically, what happens, Craig, is that during January and February, people want an African-American speaker like me to come to their church and tell them about Martin Luther King Jr. or to tell them about Black history during February. And I remember saying to him something along the lines of like, oh, it must be nice to have that many speaking invitations. And he looked at me the way that a mentor can, that shows that he completely disapproved of what I was saying and was asking me to be better. Because then he said to me, Craig, the whole idea behind Black History Month is not, hey, white churches, invite a Black speaker so you can learn about Black history. He said the whole idea behind Black History Month is that all of America, all races, talk about the importance of Black history and they own it as their own history. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is a day that we all remember Martin Luther King Jr., not just the African American community. And I looked at him and I had this question in my head, but I was scared to ask it. But I felt like I had to because I was so curious. And I said, Maury, then why do you accept these speaking invitations if you'd rather have a white preacher speak to his congregation about Black history? And it's here that he said to me, well, Craig, if I don't go, then they won't speak about it. So I accept these speaking invitations because we need to talk about Black history. My hope and prayer is that one day everyone will speak about Black history and recognize that it is all of our history. And I remember that when he told me this, I was immediately transported back to second grade. And I finally understood what was happening with my choir teacher. Here she was, the lone person of color on our faculty. And she was standing up and willing to talk about how terrible slavery was, to not let us forget it or to believe that it was some trivial sin. She was the only one who would look at us and tell us about how America had failed its people when it allowed Jim Crow laws to be put into place and upheld by the Supreme Court. And when she did this, I was mad at her because my other teachers who were white weren't saying the exact same thing. Imagine how different it would have been if everyone on staff would have reminded themselves and told us how America has not been great toward Black people throughout America's history. But instead, the burden of carrying all of Black history was put on our one Black teacher. And because I wanted to believe as a young kid that America was the greatest nation on earth, I was threatened by her and angry with her. Well, that's not fair. That's awful. And I'm ashamed to admit this to you today, but I am telling you this story because it reminds me of what happens in Numbers 11. When we look at former slaves telling us about how terrible things are and our response is, yeah, but God is good. All the time God is good. And if God isn't good, then well, everything falls apart. This is how I feel white America has looked at the testimony of former slaves and said, I know it was rough, but things are better now. And America is the greatest country on earth. And when Black history says, well, no, actually, it's not the greatest country on earth, how do we respond? Because while we might get defensive or angry or feel that if America isn't the greatest country on earth, then we need to leave or it's all been a lie. I think that it's more important to trust the story of former slaves, because what Jesus's story tells us is that is where God is found. So when we have this bizarre story about God drowning former slaves in a sea of quail, I think the thing that we can learn from it is that Christians must listen to and trust the words of the marginalized. Who is being steamrolled by society? Well, Christians must seek those voices out and listen to and trust them, because that is where we believe God is found. To my white brothers and sisters, I would like to encourage you to celebrate Black History Month and this practice by reading a Black author during the month of February. And rather than getting defensive about some of the things they say about whiteness in America, instead, I think we should listen to and trust what they are saying. In the same way, I'd like to turn to my brothers, the men who are listening to this podcast, and I would like to encourage you to listen to and trust the words of women as they speak about what it's like to grow up as a woman in a man's world. And to all of my heterosexual brothers and sisters, I would encourage you to listen to and trust queer voices all around you and what it's like to grow up as a queer person in a world that is not made for them. And if you are a person who is marginalized by society, then I would encourage you to continue to speak, to continue to trust your own story, your own experience, and know that in the midst of your oppression, that God is with you, as evidenced by the life of Jesus Christ. To all of my brothers and sisters out there who are listening from all different walks of life, may we have the courage to listen to and trust the words of the marginalized, and may we see and embrace Jesus Christ.